was the price of a magic sword. It was more than he cared to pay. Davos finished his ale, pushed away the tankard, and left the inn. On the way out, he patted the gargoyle on the head and muttered, "Luck. They would all need it." It was well after dark when Devon came down to Black Betha, leading a snow-white palfrey. "My lord father," he announced, "His Grace commands you to attend him in the chamber of the Painted Table. You are to ride the horse and come at once." It was good to see Devon, looking so splendid in his squire's raiment, but the summons made Davos uneasy. "Will he bid us sail?" he wondered. Salador San was not the only captain who felt that King's Landing was ripe for an attack, but a smuggler must learn patience.
"We have no hope of victory. I said as much to Maester Cresson the day I returned to Dragonstone, and nothing has changed. We are too few, the foes too many. If we dip our oars, we die."
Nonetheless, he climbed onto the horse. When Davos arrived at the Stone Drum, a dozen highborn knights and great bannermen were just leaving. Lord Celtigar and Valarion each gave him a curt nod and walked on while the others ignored him utterly. But Sir Axel Florence stopped for a word. Queen Selyse's uncle was a keg of a man with thick arms and bandy legs. He had the prominent ears of a Florent, even larger than his niece's. The coarse hair that sprouted from his did not stop him hearing most of what went on in the castle. For 10 years, Sir Axel had served as Castellan of Dragonstone, while Stannis sat on Robert's council in King's Landing, but of late he had emerged as the foremost of the Queen's men. "Sir Davos, it's good to see you as ever," he said.
"And you, my lord. I made a note of you this morning as well. The force gods burn with a merry light, did they not?" "They burn brightly."
Davos did not trust this man, for all his courtesy. House Florent had declared for Renly.
"The Lady Melisande tells us that sometimes R'hllor permits his faithful servants to glimpse the future in flames. It seemed to me as I watched the fire this morning that I was looking at a dozen beautiful dancers, maidens garbed in yellow silk, spinning and swirling before a great king. I think it was a true vision, sir. A glimpse of the glory that awaits his grace after we take King's Landing and the throne that is his by rights. Stannis has no taste for such dancing," Davos thought, but he dared not offend the Queen's uncle. "I saw only fire," he said, "but the smoke was making my eyes water. You must pardon me, sir. The king awaits."
He pushed past, wondering why Sir Axel had troubled himself.
"He is a Queen's man, and I am the king's."
Stannis sat at his painted table with Maester Pylos at his shoulder, an untidy pile of papers before them. "Sir," the king said when Davos entered, "come and have a look at this letter." Obediently, he selected a paper at random.
"Oh, it looks handsome enough, your grace, but I fear I cannot read the words."
Davos could decipher maps and charts as well as any, but letters and other writings were beyond his powers.
"But my Devon has learned his letters, and young Stefan and Stannis as well."
"I'd forgotten." A furrow of irritation showed between the king's brows. "Pylos, read it to him." "Your grace." The maester took up one of the parchments and cleared his throat. "All men know me for the true-born son of Stefan Baratheon, Lord of Storm's End, by his lady wife, Cassana of House Estamont. I declare upon the honor of my house that my beloved brother Robert, our late king, left no true-born issue of his body, the boy Joffrey, the boy Tommen, and the girl Marcella being abominations born of incest between Cersei Lannister and her brother Jaime the Kingslayer. By right of birth and blood, I do this day lay claim to the Iron Throne of the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros. Let all true men declare their loyalty, done in the light of the Lord, under the sign and seal of Stannis of House Baratheon, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms. The parchment rustled softly as Pylos laid it down.
Make it Sir Jaime, the Kingslayer, henceforth, Stannis said, frowning. Whatever else a man may be, he remains a knight. I don't know that we ought to call Robert my beloved brother either. He loved me no more than he had to, nor I him.
A harmless courtesy, Your Grace, Pylos said.
A lie. Take it out.
Stannis turned to Davos.
The Maester tells me that we have 117 ravens on hand. I mean to use them all. 117 ravens will carry 117 copies of my letter to every corner of the realm, from the arbor to the wall. Perhaps 100 will win through against storm and hawk and arrow. If so, 100 maesters will read my words to as many lords in as many solars and bedchambers. And then the letters will, like as not, be consigned to the fire, and lips pledged to silence. These great lords love Joffrey, or Renly, or Robb Stark. I am their rightful king. But they will deny me, if they can. So, I have need of you. I'm yours to command, my king, as ever.
Stannis nodded.
I mean for you to take Blackbether north, to Gulltown, the Fingers, the Three Sisters, even White Harbor. Your son Dale will go south in Wraith, past Cape Wrath and the Broken Arm, all along the coast of Dawn, as far as the Arbor. Each of you will carry a chest of letters, and you will deliver one to every port and holdfast and fishing village. Nail them to the doors of septs and inns for every man to read who can.
Davos said,
That will be few enough.
Sir Davos speaks truly, Your Grace, said Maester Pylos. It would be better to have the letters read aloud.
Better, but more dangerous, said Stannis. These words will not be kindly received. Give me knights to do the reading, Davos said. That will carry more weight than anything I might say.
Stannis seemed well satisfied with that.
I can give you such men, yes. I have 100 knights who would sooner read than fight. Be open where you can and stealthy where you must. Use every smuggler's trick you know, the black sails, the hidden coves, whatever it requires. If you run short of letters, capture a few septons and set them to copying out more. I mean to use your second son as well. He will take Lady Maria across the narrow sea to Braavos and the other free cities to deliver other letters to the men who rule there. The world will know of my claim and of Cersei's infamy.
You can tell them, Davos thought, but will they believe? He glanced thoughtfully at Maester Pylos. The king caught the look.
Maester, perhaps you ought to get to your writing. We will need a great many letters, and soon.
As you will. Pylos bowed and took his leave. The king waited until he was gone before he said, What is it you would not say in the presence of my maester, Davos?
My liege Pylos is pleasant enough, but I cannot see the chain about his neck without mourning for Maester Cresson.
Is it his fault the old man died? Stannis glanced into the fire.
I never wanted Cresson at that feast. He angered me, yes. He'd give me bad counsel, but I did not want him dead. I hoped he might be granted a few years of ease and comfort. He'd earned that much, at least, but...
He ground his teeth together.
But he died, and Pylos serves me ably. Pylos is the least of it. The letter. What did your lords make of it, I wonder?
Stannis snorted.
Celtigar pronounced it admirable. If I showed him the contents of my privy, he would declare that admirable as well. The others bob their heads up and down like a flock of geese. All but Valerian, who said that steel would decide the matter, not words on parchment. As if I'd never suspected. The others take my lords. I'll hear your views. Your words were blunt and strong. And true. And true. Yet you have no proof of this incest. No more than you did a year ago. There's proof of a sort at Storm's End. Robert's bastard. The one he fathered on my wedding night, in the very bed they'd made up for me and my bride. Delenna was a florent, and a maiden when he took her. So Robert acknowledged the babe. Edric Storm, they call him. He is said to be the very image of my brother. If men were to see him, and then look at Joffrey and Tommen, they could not help but wonder, I would think. Yet how are men to see him if he is at Storm's End? Stannis drummed his fingers on the painted table. It is a difficulty, one of many. He raised his eyes. You have more to say about the letter. Well, get on with it. I did not make you a knight so you could learn to mouth empty courtesies. I have my lords for that. Say what you would say, Davos. Davos bowed his head. There was a phrase at the end. How did it go? Done in the light of the Lord. Yes, the king's jaw was clenched. Your people will mislike those words. As you did, said Stannis sharply. If you were to say instead, done in the sight of gods and men, or by the grace of gods old and new. Have you gone devout on me, smuggler? Ah, that was to be my question for you, my liege. Was it now? It sounds as though you love my new god no more than you love my new maester. I do not know this Lord of Light, Davos admitted, but I knew the gods we burned this morning. The smith has kept my ship safe, while the mother has given me 7 strong sons. Your wife has given you 7 strong sons. Did you pray to her? It was wood we burned this morning. That may be so, Davos said. But when I was a boy in Flea Bottom, begging for a copper, sometimes a septons would feed me. I feed you now. Oh, you have given me 100 place at your table, and in return I give you truth. Your people will not love you if you take from them the gods they have always worshipped, and give them one whose very name sounds queer on their tongues. Stannis stood abruptly. R'hllor, why is that so hard? They will not love me, you say. When have they ever loved me? How can I lose something I've never owned? He moved to the south window to gaze out at the moonlit sea. I stopped believing in gods the day I saw the Windproud break up across the bay. Any god so monstrous as to drown my mother and father would never have my worship, I vowed. In King's Landing, the High Septon would prattle at me and how all justice and goodness flowed from the 7. But all I ever saw of either was made by men. If you do not believe in gods, why trouble with this new one? Stannis broke in. I've asked myself as well. I know little and care less of gods, but the Red Priestess has power. Yes, but what sort of power? Cresson had wisdom. I trusted in his wisdom and your wiles, and what did they avail me, smuggler? The Storm Lords sent you packing. I went to them a beggar, and they laughed at me. Well, there will be no more begging, and no more laughing either. The Iron Throne is mine by rights, but how am I to take it? There are 4 kings in the realm, and 3 of them have more men and more gold than I do. I have ships, and I have the Red Woman. Half my knights are afraid even to say her name. Did you know? If she can do nothing else, a sorceress who can inspire such dread in grown men is not to be despised. A frightened man is a beaten man, and perhaps she can do more. I mean to find out. When I was a lad, I found an injured goshawk and nursed her back to health. Proudwing, I named her. She would perch on my shoulder and flutter from room to room after me and take food from my hand. But she would not soar. Time and again, I would take her hawking, but she never flew higher than the treetops. Robert called her Weakwing. He owned a grey falcon named Thunderclap, who never missed her strike. One day, our great-uncle, Sir Harbert, told me to try a different bird. I was making a fool of myself with Proudwing, he said, and he was right.
Stannis Baratheon turned away from the window and the ghosts who moved upon the southern sea.
The Seven have never brought me so much as a sparrow. It's time I tried another orc, Davos. A red orc.
Theon. There was no safe anchorage at Pyke, but Theon Greyjoy wished to look on his father's castle from the sea, to see it as he had seen it last, 10 years before, when Robert Baratheon's war galley had borne him away to be a ward of Eddard Stark. On that day, he had stood beside the rail, listening to the stroke of the oars and the pounding of the master's drum, while he watched Pyke dwindle in the distance. Now he wanted to see it grow larger, to rise from the sea before him. Obedient to his wishes, the Miraham beat her way past the point, with her sail snapping and her captain cursing the wind and his crew and the follies of high-born lordlings. Theon drew the hood of his cloak up against the spray and looked for home. The shore was all sharp rocks and glowering cliffs, and the castle seemed one with the rest, its towers and walls and bridges quarried from the same grey-black stone, wet by the same salt waves, festooned with the same spreading patches of dark green lichen, speckled by the droppings of the same sea birds. The point of land on which the Greyjoys had raised their fortress had once thrust like a sword into the bowels of the ocean, but the waves had hammered at it day and night until the land broke and shattered thousands of years past. All that remained were three bare and barren islands and a dozen towering stacks of rock that rose from the water like the pillars of some sea god's temple while the angry waves foamed and crashed among them. Drear, dark, forbidding, Pyke stood atop those islands and pillars, almost a part of them. Its curtain wall closing off the headland around the foot of the great stone bridge that leapt from the cliff top to the largest islet, dominated by the massive bulk of the great keep. Farther out were the kitchen keep and the bloody keep, each on its own island. Towers and outbuildings clung to the stacks beyond, linked to each other by covered archways when the pillars stood close, by long, swaying walks of wood and rope when they did not. The sea tower rose from the outmost island at the point of the broken sword, the oldest part of the castle, round and tall, the sheer-sided pillar on which it stood half eaten through by the endless battering of the waves. The base of the tower was white from centuries of salt spray, the upper stories green from the lichen that crawled over it like a thick blanket, the jagged crown black with soot from its nightly watchfire. Above the sea tower snapped his father's banner. The Miraham was too far off for Theon to see more than the cloth itself, but he knew the device it bore. The gold kraken of House Greyjoy, arms writhing and reaching against a black field. The banner streamed from an iron mast, shivering and twisting as the wind gusted, like a bird struggling to take flight. And here at least the dire wolf of Stark did not fly above, casting its shadow down upon the Greyjoy Kraken. Theon had never seen a more stirring sight. In the sky behind the castle, the fine red tail of the comet was visible through thin, scuttling clouds. All the way from Riveron to Seaguard, the Malisters had argued about its meaning.
"It is my comet,"
Theon told himself, sliding a hand into his fur-lined cloak to touch the oilskin pouch snug in its pocket. Inside was the letter Robb Stark had given him, paper as good as a crown.
"Does a castle look as you remember it, my lord?"
the captain's daughter asked as she pressed herself against his arm.
"It looks smaller," Theon confessed, "though perhaps that's only the distance."
The Miraham was a fat-bellied southern merchanter up from Old Town, carrying wine and cloth and seed to trade for iron ore. Her captain was a fat-bellied southern merchanter as well, and the stony sea that foamed at the feet of the castle made his plump lips quiver, so he stayed well out. Farther out than Theon would have liked. An iron-born captain in a long ship would have taken them along the cliffs and under the high bridge that spanned the gap between the gatehouse and the great keep. But this plump old-towner had neither the craft, the crew, nor the courage to attempt such a thing. So they sailed past at a safe distance, and Theon must content himself with seeing Pike from afar. Even so, the Miraham had to struggle mightily to keep itself off those rocks.
"It must be windy there," the captain's daughter observed.
He laughed.
"Windy and cold and damp. A miserable hard place, in truth. But my lord father once told me that hard places breed hard men, and hard men rule the world."
The captain's face was as green as the sea when he came bowing up to Theon and asked,
"May we make for port now, my lord?"
"You may," Theon said, a faint smile playing about his lips. The promise of gold had turned the old towner into a shameless lickspittle. It would have been a much different voyage if a longship from the islands had been waiting at Seaguard as he'd hoped. Iron-born captains were proud and willful and did not go in awe of a man's blood. The islands were too small for awe, and a longship smaller still. If every captain was a king aboard his own ship, as was often said, it was small wonder they named the islands the Land of 10,000 Kings. And when you had seen your kings shit over the rail and turn green in a storm, it was hard to bend the knee and pretend they were gods. "The drowned god makes men," old King Euron Redhand had once said thousands of years ago, "but it's men who make crowns." A longship would have made the crossing in half the time as well. The Miraham was a wallowing tub, if truth be told, and he would not care to be aboard her in a storm. Still, Theon could not be too unhappy. He was here, undrowned, and the voyage had offered certain other amusements. He put an arm around the captain's daughter.
"Summon me when we make Lordsport," he told her father. "We'll be below in my cabin."
He led the girl away aft, while her father watched them go in sullen silence. The cabin was the captain's, in truth, but it had been turned over to Theon's use when they sailed from Seaguard. The captain's daughter had not been turned over to his use, but she had come to his bed willingly enough all the same. A cup of wine, a few whispers, and there she was. The girl was a shade plump for his taste, with skin as splotchy as oatmeal, but her breast filled his hands nicely, and she had been a maiden the first time he took her. That was surprising at her age, but Theon found it diverting. He did not think the captain approved, and that was amusing as well, watching the man struggle to swallow his outrage while performing his courtesies to the High Lord, the rich purse of gold he'd been promised never far from his thoughts. As Theon shrugged out of his wet cloak, the girl said,
"You must be so happy to see your home again, my lord, How many years have you been away?
10, or close as makes no matter, he told her. I was a boy of 10 when I was taken to Winterfell as a ward of Eddard Stark. A ward in name, a hostage in truth. Half his day is a hostage, but no longer. His life was his own again, and nowhere a Stark to be seen. He drew the captain's daughter close and kissed her on her ear. Take off your cloak. She dropped her eyes, suddenly shy, but did as he bid her. When the heavy garment, sodden with spray, fell from her shoulders to the deck, she gave him a little bow and smiled anxiously. She looked rather stupid when she smiled, but he had never required a woman to be clever. Come here, he told her. She did.
I've never seen the Iron Islands.
Count yourself fortunate. Theon stroked her hair. It was fine and dark, though the wind had made a tangle of it. The islands are stern and stony places, scant of comfort and bleak of prospect. Death is never far here, and life is mean and meagre. Men spend their nights drinking ale and arguing over whose lot is worse. The fisher folk who fight the sea, or the farmers who try and scratch a crop from the poor thin soil. If truth be told, the miners have it worse than either, breaking their backs down in the dark, and for what? Iron, lead, tin? Those are our treasures. Small wonder the iron men of old turned to raiding. A stupid girl did not seem to be listening.
I could go ashore with you, she said. I would, if it please you.
You could go ashore, Theon agreed, squeezing her breast. But not with me, I fear.
I'd work in your castle, my lord. I can clean fish and bake bread and churn butter. Father says my pepper crab stew is the best he's ever tasted. You could find me a place in your kitchens and I could make you pepper crab stew.
And warm my bed by night. He reached for the laces of her bodice and began to undo them, his fingers deft and practiced. Once I might have carried you home as a prize and kept you to wife, whether you willed it or no. The iron men of old did such things. A man and his rock wife, his true bride, iron-born like himself, but he had his salt wives too, women captured on raids. The girl's eyes grew wide, and not because he had bared her breasts.
I would be your salt wife, my lord.
I fear those days are gone. Theon's finger circled one heavy teat, spiralling in toward the fat brown nipple. No longer may we ride the wind with fire and sword, taking what we want. Now we scratch in the ground and toss lines in the sea like other men and count ourselves lucky if we have salt cod and porridge enough to get us through a winter. He took her nipple in his mouth and bit it until she gasped.
You can put it in me again, if it please you, she whispered in his ear as he sucked.
When he raised his head from her breast, the skin was dark red where his mouth had marked her.
It will please me to teach you something new. Unlace me and pleasure me with your mouth. With my mouth?
His thumb brushed lightly over her full lips.
It's what those lips were made for, sweetling. If you were my salt wife, you'd do as I command.
She was timid at first, but learned quickly for such a stupid girl, which pleased him. Her mouth was as wet and sweet as her cunt, and this way he did not have to listen to her mindless prattle. Once I would have kept her as a salt wife in truth, he thought to himself, as he slid his fingers through her tangled hair. Once, when we still kept the old way, lived by the axe, instead of the pick, taking what we would, be it wealth, women, or glory. In those days, the ironborn did not work mines. That was labor for the captives brought back from the hustings, and so too the sorry business of farming and tending goats and sheep. War was an iron man's proper trade. The Drowned God had made them to reave and rape, to carve out kingdoms and write their names in fire and blood and song. Aegon the Dragon had destroyed the old way when he burned Black Heron, gave Heron's kingdom back to the weakling rivermen, and reduced the Iron Islands to an insignificant backwater of a much greater realm. Yet the old red tales were still told around driftwood fires and smoking hearths all across the islands, even behind the high stone halls of Pike. Theon's father numbered among his titles the style of Lord Reaper, and the Greyjoy words boasted that we do not so. It had been to bring back the old way more than for the empty vanity of a crown that Lord Balon had staged his great rebellion. Robert Baratheon had written a bloody end to that hope with the help of his friend Eddard Stark, but both men were dead now. Mere boys ruled in their stead, and the realm that Aegon the Conqueror had forged was smashed and sundered.
This is the season, Theon thought, as the captain's daughter slid her lips up and down the length of him. The season, the year, the day, and I am the man.
He smiled crookedly, wondering what his father would say when Theon told him that he, the last-born babe and hostage, he had succeeded where Lord Balon himself had failed. His climax came on him sudden as a storm, and he filled the girl's mouth with his seed. Startled, she tried to pull away, but Theon held her tight by the hair. Afterwards, she crawled up beside him.
Did I please, my lord?
Well enough, he told her.
It tasted salty, she murmured.
Like the sea, she nodded.
I've always loved the sea, my lord.
As I have, he said, rolling her nipple idly between his fingers. It was true. The sea meant freedom to the men of the Iron Islands. He had forgotten that until the Mirahem had raised sail at Seaguard. The sounds brought old feelings back, the creak of wood and rope, the captain's shouted commands, the snap of the sails as the wind filled them, each as familiar as the beating of his own heart, and as comforting. I must remember this, Theon vowed to himself. I must never go far from the sea again.
Take me with you, my lord, the captain's daughter begged. I don't need to go to your castle. I can stay in some town and be your sort wife.
She reached out to stroke his cheek. Theon Greyjoy pushed a hand aside and climbed off the bunk.
My place is Pike, and yours is on this ship.
I can't stay here now.
He laced up his breeches.
Why not?
My father, she told him. Once you're gone, he'll punish me, my lord. He'll call me names and hit me.
Theon swept his cloak off his peg and over his shoulders.
Fathers are like that,
he admitted, as he pinned the folds with a silver clasp.
Tell him he should be pleased. As many times as I've fucked you, you're likely with child. It's not every man who has the honour of raising a king's bastard.
She looked at him stupidly, so he left her there. The Mirahem was rounding a wooded point. Below the pine-clad bluffs, a dozen fishing boats were pulling in their nets. The big cog stayed well out from them, tacking. Theon moved to the bow for a better view. He saw the castle first, the stronghold of the Butleys. When he was a boy, it had been timber and wattle, but Robert Baratheon had razed the structure to the ground. Lord Sawain had rebuilt in stone. For now, a small square keep crowned the hill. Pale green flags drooped from the squat corner towers, each emblazoned with a shoal of silvery fish. Beneath the dubious protection of the fish-ridden little castle lay the village of Lordsport, its harbour aswarm with ships. When last he'd seen Lordsport, it had been a smoking wasteland, the skeletons of burned longships and smashed galleys littering the stony shore like the bones of dead leviathans, the houses no more than broken walls and cold ashes. After 10 years, few traces of the war remained. The small folk had built new hovels with the stones of the old and cut fresh sod for their roofs. A new inn had risen beside the landing, twice the size of the old one, with a lower story of cut stone and two upper stories of timber. The sept beyond had never been rebuilt, though. Only a seven-sided foundation remained where it had stood. Robert Baratheon's fury had soured the Iron Men's taste for the new gods, it would seem. Theon was more interested in ships than gods. Among the masts of countless fishing boats, he spied a Tyroshi trading galley offloading beside a lumbering Ebonese cog with her black-tarred hull. A great number of longships, 50 or 60 at the least, stood out to sea or lay beached on the pebble shore to the north. Some of the sails bore devices from the other islands. The Blood Moon of Winch, Lord Goodbrother's banded black warhorn, Hallord's silver scythe. Theon searched for his Uncle Urin's Silence. Of that lean and terrible red ship, he saw no sign. But his father's great Kraken was there, her bow ornamented with a grey iron ram in the shape of its namesake. Had Lord Balin anticipated him and called the Greyjoy banners? His hand went inside his cloak again to the oilskin pouch. No one knew of his letter but Robb Stark. They were no fools to entrust their secret to a bird. Still, Lord Balin was no fool either. He might well have guessed why his son was coming home at long last and acted accordingly. The thought did not please him. His father's war was long done and lost. This was Theon's hour, his plan, his glory, and in time, his crown. Yet, if the longships are hosting, it might be only a caution, now that he thought on it, a defensive move, lest the war spill out across the sea. Old men were cautious by nature. His father was old now, and so too his uncle, Victarion, who commanded the Iron Fleet. His uncle, Euron, was a different song, to be sure, but the silence did not seem to be in port. "It's all for the good," Theon told himself. "This way, I shall be able to strike all the more quickly." As the Miriam made her way landward, Theon paced the deck restlessly, scanning the shore. He had not thought to find Lord Balin himself at Quayside, but surely his father would have sent someone to meet him. Silas Sourmouth, the steward, Lord Butley, perhaps even Dagmar Cleftjaw. It would be good to look on Dagmar's hideous old face again. It was not as though they had no word of his arrival. Robb had sent ravens from River Run, and when they'd found no longship at Seaguard, Jason Mallister had sent his own birds to Pike, supposing that Robb's were lost. Yet he saw no familiar faces, no honour guard waiting to escort him from Lordsport to Pike, only small folk going about their small business. Shore hands rolled casks of wine off the Tyroshi trader, fisher folk cried the day's catch, children ran and played. A priest, in the seawater robes of the drowned god, was leading a pair of horses along the pebble shore, while above him, a slattern leaned out a window in the inn, calling out to some passing Ebonese sailors. A handful of Lordsport merchants had gathered to meet the ship. They shouted questions as the Miriam was tying up.
"We're out of Old Town," the captain called down. "Bearing apples and oranges, wines from the arbor, feathers from the summer isles. I have pepper, woven leathers, a boat of Moorish lace, mirrors for my lady, a pair of Old Town wood harps, sweet as any you've ever heard."
The gangplank descended with a creak and a thud.
"And I brought your heir back to you."
The Lordsport men gazed on Theon with blank, bovine eyes, and he realized they did not know who he was. It made him angry. He pressed a golden dragon into the captain's palm. "Have your men bring my things." Without waiting for a reply, he strode down the gangplank.
"Innkeeper," he barked, "I require a horse."
"As you say, my lord,"
the man responded without so much as a bow. He had forgotten how bold the Ironborn could be.
Happens as I have one might do. Where will you be riding, my lord? Pike!
The fool still did not know him. He should have worn his good doublet, with a kraken embroidered on the breast.
You want to be off soon to reach Pike afore dark, the innkeeper said. My boy will go with you and show you the way.
Your boy will not be needed, a deep voice called, nor your horse. I shall see my nephew back to his father's house.
The speaker was the priest he had seen leading the horses along the shoreline. As the man approached, the small folk bent the knee, and Theon heard the innkeeper murmur, "Damp air." Tall and thin, with fierce black eyes and a beak of a nose, the priest was garbed in mottled robes of green and grey and blue, the swirling collars of the drowned god. A water skin hung under his arm on a leather strap, and ropes of dried seaweed were braided through his waist-long black hair and untrimmed beard. A memory prodded at Theon. In one of his rare, curt letters, Lord Balin had written of his youngest brother going down in a storm and turning holy when he washed up safe on shore.
"Uncle Aaron," he said doubtfully.
"Nephew Theon," the priest replied. "Your lord father bid me fetch you. Come."
"In a moment, uncle."
He turned back to the Mirham.
"My things," he commanded the captain.
A sailor fetched him down his tall yew bow and quiver of arrows, but it was the captain's daughter who brought the pack with his good clothing.
"My lord,"
her eyes were red. When he took the pack, she made as if to embrace him, there in front of her own father and his priestly uncle and half the island. Theon turned deftly aside.
"You have my thanks."
"Please," she said. "I do love you well, my lord."
"I must go."
He hurried after his uncle, who was already well down the pier. Theon caught him with a dozen long strides.
"I had not looked for you, uncle. After 10 years, I thought perhaps my lord father and lady mother might come themselves, or send Dagmar with an honour guard."
"It is not for you to question the commands of the Lord Reaper of Pike."
The priest's manner was chilly, most unlike the man Theon remembered. Aaron Greyjoy had been the most amiable of his uncles, feckless and quick to laugh, fond of songs, ale, and women.
"As to Dagmar, the cleft jaw is gone to Old Wick at your father's behest, to roust the stone houses and the drums."
"To what purpose? Why are the longships hosting?"
"Why have longships ever hosted?"
His uncle had left the horses tied up in front of the waterside inn. When they reached them, he turned to Theon.
"Tell me true, nephew. Do you pray to the wolf gods now?"
Theon seldom prayed at all, but it was not something you confessed to a priest, even your father's own brother.
"Ned Stark prayed to a tree. No, I care nothing for Stark's gods."
"Good. Kneel."
The ground was all stones and mud.
"Uncle, kneel, or are you too proud now, a lordling of the green lands come amongst us?"
Theon knelt. He had a purpose here, and might need Aaron's help to achieve it. A crown was worth a little mud and horse shit on his breeches, he supposed.
"Bow your head."
Lifting the skin, his uncle pulled the cork and directed a thin stream of seawater down upon Theon's head. It drenched his hair and ran over his forehead into his eyes. Sheets washed down his cheeks, and a finger crept under his cloak and doublet and down his back, a cold rivulet along his spine. The salt made his eyes burn until it was all he could do not to cry out. He could taste the ocean on his lips.
"Let Theon, your servant, be born again from the sea as you were,"
Aaron Greyjoy intoned.
"Bless him with salt, bless him with stone, bless him with steel. Nephew, do you still know the words?"
"What is dead may never die," Theon said, remembering.
what is dead may never die, his uncle echoed, but rises again harder and stronger. Stand. Theon stood, blinking back tears from the salt in his eyes. Wordless, his uncle corked the water skin, untied his horse and mounted. Theon did the same. They set off together, leaving the inn and the harbour behind them, up past the castle of Lord Butley into the stony hills. The priest ventured no further word. I've been half my life away from home, Theon ventured at last. Will I find the islands changed? Men fish the sea, dig in the earth, and die. Women birth children in blood and pain, and die. Night follows day. The winds and tides remain. The islands are as our God made them. God, she has grown grim, Theon thought. Will I find my sister and my lady mother at Pike? You will not. Your mother dwells at Harlaw with her own sister. It is less raw there, and her cough troubles her. Your sister has taken Black Wind to Great Wick with messages from your lord father. She will return here long, you may be sure. Theon did not need to be told that Black Wind was Usher's longship. He had not seen his sister in 10 years, but that much he knew of her. Odd that she would call it that, when Robb Stark had a wolf named Grey Wind. Stark is grey, and Greyjoy's black, he murmured, smiling. But it seems we're both windy. The priest had nothing to say to that. And what of you, Uncle? Theon asked. You were no priest when I was taken from Pike. I remember how you would sing the old reaving songs, standing on the table with a horn of ale in hand. Young I was, and vain, Aaron Greyjoy said. But the sea washed my follies and my vanities away. That man drowned, nephew. His lungs filled with seawater, and the fish ate the scales off his eyes. When I rose again, I saw clearly.
He is as mad as he is sour.
Theon had liked what he remembered of the old Aaron Greyjoy. Uncle, why has my father called his swords and sails? Doubtless he would tell you at Pike.
I would know his plans now.
From me you shall not. We are commanded not to speak of this to any man.
Even to me?
Theon's anger flared. He'd led men in war, hunted with a king, won honour in tawny melees, ridden with Brynden Blackfish and Greyjon Umber, fought in the Whispering Wood, bedded more girls than he could name, and yet this uncle was treating him as though he were still a child of 10. If my father makes plans for war, I must know of them. I'm not any man. I'm heir to Pike and the Iron Islands. As to that, his uncle said, we shall see. The words were a slap in the face.
We shall see? My brothers are both dead. I am my lord father's only living son.
Your sister lives.
Asher, he thought, confounded. She was 3 years older than Theon, yet still.
A woman may inherit only if there's no male heir in the direct line, he insisted loudly. I will not be cheated of my rights, I warn you. His uncle grunted. You warn a servant of the drowned god, boy? You have forgotten more than you know. And you are a great fool if you believe your lord father will ever hand these holy islands over to a Stark. Now be silent. The ride is long enough without your magpie chatterings. Theon held his tongue, though not without a struggle.
So that is the way of it, he thought.
As if 10 years in Winterfell could make a Stark. Lord Eddard had raised him among his own children, but Theon had never been one of them. The whole castle, from Lady Stark to the lowliest kitchen scullion, knew he was hostage to his father's good behavior and treated him accordingly. Even the bastard Jon Snow had been accorded more honor than he had. Lord Eddard had tried to play the father from time to time, but to Theon he had always remained the man who'd brought blood and fire to Pike and taken him
from his home. As a boy, he had lived in fear of Stark's stern face and great dark sword. His wife was, if anything, even more distant and suspicious. As for their children, the younger ones had been mewling babes for most of his years at Winterfell. Only Rob and his base-born half-brother, Jon Snow, had been old enough to be worth his notice. The bastard was a sullen boy, quick to sense a slight, jealous of Theon's high birth and Rob's regard for him. For Rob himself, Theon did have a certain affection as for a younger brother, but it would be best not to mention that. In Pyke, it would seem, the old wars were still being fought. That ought not surprise him. The Iron Islands lived in the past. The present was too hard and bitter to be borne. Besides, his father and uncles were old, and the old lords were like that. They took their dusty feuds to the grave, forgetting nothing and forgiving less. It had been the same with the Malisters, his companions on the ride from Riverrun to Seaguard. Patrick Malister was not too ill a fellow. They shared a taste for wenches, wine, and hawking. But when old Lord Jason saw his heir growing overly fond of Theon's company, he had taken Patrick aside to remind him that Seaguard had been built to defend the coast against reavers from the Iron Islands, the Greyjoys of Pyke chief among them. Their booming tower was named for its immense bronze bell, rung of old to call the townsfolk and farmhands into the castle when longships were sighted on the western horizon. "Never mind that the bell has been rung just once in 300 years," Patrick told Theon the day after, as he shared his father's cautions and a jug of green apple wine. "When my brother stormed Seaguard," Theon said. Lord Jason had slain Roderick Greyjoy under the walls of the castle and thrown the Iron Man back into the bay. "If your father supposes that I bear him some enmity for that, it's only because he never knew Roderick." They had a laugh over that as they raced ahead to an amorous young miller's wife that Patrick knew. Would that Patrick were with me now. Malister or no, he was a more amiable riding companion than this sour old priest that his uncle Aaron had turned into. The path they rode wound up and up into bare and stony hills. Soon they were out of sight of the sea, though the smell of salt still hung sharp in the damp air. They kept a steady, plodding pace, past a shepherd's croft and the abandoned workings of a mine. This new holy Aeron Greyjoy was not much for talk. They rode in a gloom of silence. Finally, Theon could suffer it no longer. "Robb Stark is Lord of Winterfell now," he said. Aeron rode on. "One wolf is much like the other. Robb has broken fealty with the Iron Throne and crowned himself king in the north. There's war. The Maester's ravens fly over salt as soon as rock. This news is old and cold." "It means a new day, Uncle." "Every morning brings a new day, much like the old. In Riverrun, they would tell you different. They say the Red Comet is a herald of a new age, a messenger from the gods." "A sign it is," the priest agreed. "But from our god, not theirs. A burning brand it is, such as our people carried of old. It is the flame the drowned god brought from the sea, and it proclaims a rising tide. It is time to hoist our sails and go forth into the world with fire and sword as he did." Theon smiled. "I could not agree more. A man agrees with God as a raindrop with a storm. This raindrop will, one day, be a king, old man." Theon had suffered quite enough of his uncle's gloom. He put his spurs into his horse and trotted on ahead, smiling. It was nigh on sunset when they reached the walls of Pyke, a crescent of dark stone that ran from cliff to cliff, with a gatehouse in the center and three square towers to either side. Theon could still make out the scars left by the stones of Robert Baratheon's catapults. A new south tower had risen from the ruins of the old, its stone a paler shade of grey, and as yet unmarred by patches of lichen. That was where Robert had made his breach, swarming in over the rubble and corpses with his war hammer in hand and Ned Stark at his side. Theon had watched from the safety of the sea tower, and sometimes he still saw the torches in his dreams and heard the dull thunder of the collapse. The gate stood open to him, the rusted iron portcullis drawn up. The guards atop the battlements watched with strangers' eyes as Theon Greyjoy came home at last. Beyond the curtain wall were 50 acres of headland, hard against the sky and the sea. The stables were here, and the kennels, and a scatter of other outbuildings. Sheep and swine huddled in their pens while the castle dogs ran free. To the south were the cliffs and the wide stone bridge to the great keep. Theon could hear the crashing of waves as he swung down from his saddle. A stableman came to take his horse. A pair of gaunt children and some thralls stared at him with dull eyes, but there was no sign of his lord father, nor anyone else he recalled from boyhood. A bleak and bitter homecoming, he thought. The priest had not dismounted. Will you not stay the night and share our meat and mead, uncle? Bring you, I was told. You are brought. Now I return to our God's business. Aaron Greyjoy turned his horse and rode slowly out beneath the muddy spikes of the portcullis. A bent-back old crone in a shapeless grey dress approached him warily.
My lord, I am sent to show you two chambers.
By whose bidding?
Your lord father, my lord.
Theon pulled off his gloves.
So, you do know who I am. Why is my father not here to greet me?
He awaits you in the sea tower, my lord, when you are rested from your trip.
And I thought Ned Stark cold. And who are you?
Hellier, who keeps his castle for your lord father.
Silas was steward here. They called him Sourmouth.
Even now, Theon could recall the whiny stench from the old man's breath.
Dead these 5 years, my lord.
And what of Maester Caelan? Where is he?
He sleeps in the sea. Windermere keeps the ravens now.
It is as if I were a stranger here, Theon thought. Nothing has changed, and yet everything has changed. Show me to my chambers, woman, he commanded.
Bowing stiffly, she led him across the headland to the bridge. That at least was as he remembered, the ancient stones slick with spray and spotted by lichen, the sea foaming under their feet like some great wild beast, the salt wind clutching at their clothes. Whenever he'd imagined his homecoming, he had always pictured himself returning to the snug bedchamber in the sea tower where he'd slept as a child. Instead, the old woman led him to the bloody keep. The halls here were larger and better furnished, if no less cold nor damp. Theon was given a suite of chilly rooms with ceilings so high that they were lost in gloom. He might have been more impressed if he had not known that these were the very chambers that had given the bloody keep its name. 1,000 years before, the sons of the River King had been slaughtered here, hacked to bits in their beds, so that pieces of their bodies might be sent back to their father on the mainland. But Greyjoys were not murdered in Pike, except once in a great while, by their brothers, and his brothers were both dead. It was not fear of ghosts that made him glance about with distaste. The wall hangings were green with mildew, the mattress musty-smelling and sagging, the rushes old and brittle. Years had come and gone since these chambers had last been opened. The damp went bone deep. I'll have a basin of hot water and a fire in this hearth, he told the crew.